Okay, I want to start today by asking you to do a little mental rearranging. Imagine your brain is a house. Usually we keep the furniture in specific rooms, right? You have
Right.
the kitchen where you cook, the bedroom where you sleep, maybe a home office where you do your work.
I like this analogy, keeping things tidy.
Exactly. But in our intellectual lives, we do the same thing. We have these distinct boxes. In one box, you've got philosophy, the dusty old books, the big why are we here stuff. In a second box, totally separate, you have spirituality, prayer, meditation, that sense of awe or connection to something bigger.
And let me guess the third box. The one that, well, usually scares people off.
You got it. The third box is mathematics.
Yeah.
Cold, hard logic.
Calculus. Equations on a blackboard.
Can we keep the lid sealed tight on that one?
We do. You don't usually see a monk meditating on a quadratic equation.
No, it sounds like the setup to a complicated joke. But traditionally, yes, we silo them. Philosophy is for the thinkers, spirituality for the believers, and math is, I guess, for the builders. Well, today we are taking a sledgehammer to those walls. We're diving into a source that argues these three things, philosophy, spirituality, and mathematics, are actually a peculiar trinity.
A trilogy.
Yes, and the argument is that you actually need to combine them if you want to understand the architecture of reality.
It's a fascinating premise. We're exploring the God Math Chronicles, a journey into the divine order of the universe, based on the work of Dr. Matthews K. George. And what I appreciate about this deep dive is that it isn't just saying math is cool, it's making a massive metaphysical claim.
It really is. It tackles that question that tends to come up after a few drinks late at night. Is mathematics something humans invented, like, the rules of baseball or the alphabet? Or is it something we discovered?
Is it the pre-existing language of the universe itself?
Exactly.
That is the big question. Is it invention or discovery? And Dr. Jord is firmly in the discovery camp.
So what's the core thesis?
The core thesis here is that there's a divine blueprint woven into the very fabric of reality, and math is effectively the decoder ring. It's the tool we use to read the mind of the architect.
Which sounds very abstract, almost academic. But what struck me about this source material is that it doesn't start in a lecture hall. It starts with a very relatable human moment.
Right, it grounds the theory and experience. It starts with the author as a 6-year-old child in Malaysia. He describes lying in the tall grass, just looking up at the night sky.
I think we've all had that moment.
We have that feeling of being small but also connected.
The starry night feeling.
Exactly. He describes this overwhelming sense of connection, humbling but exhilarating. He sensed a pattern, a divine order, long before he had the vocabulary or the equations to describe it.
But the real turning point, the catalyst, as the source calls it, came later when he was actually doing the math.
Yes.
He talks about working through an elegant proof. Now, I have to be honest, back in high school, elegant was not the word I used for geometry proofs.
I think painful or confusing is more common.
Definitely.
But for a mathematician, elegance means simplicity, power, and truth all rolled into one. He describes working through a proof and hitting a moment of crystalline clarity.
And what did that feel like?
He realized he wasn't just manipulating symbols on a page to get a grade. He felt like he was uncovering a fundamental truth that had been sitting there waiting for him, since the beginning of time.
That distinction is key. It's the shift from calculating to witnessing.
Precisely. And it led him to realize that to truly grasp the universe, you need that peculiar trinity we mentioned. You need the ethereal questions of philosophy to ask why.
The inner landscape of spirituality to ask, who am I?
And the concrete, rigorous precision of mathematics to ask how, if you drop one, the stool falls over.
Okay, but let's play devil's advocate for a second. Is Dr. George claiming to be the first person to figure this out? Because math is the language of God. It sounds like something I've seen on a poster somewhere.
No, and to his credit, the source leans heavily on the fact that this is ancient wisdom. He's not inventing this, he's echoing a lineage. He goes back to the ancients who believed all is number.
Which is very Pythagorean.
Very. For the ancients, geometry wasn't about measuring a field to build a fence. It was about studying the mind of God. And the source traces this through some heavy hitters, Thomas Aquinas, for example.
See, that one surprised me. Aquinas is the Summa Theologica guy.
Yeah.
I think of him as pure theology, not math.
But that's because we view them as separate boxes. The source explains that Aquinas saw creation as a grand, divinely authored text.
So reason and faith are complementary.
Exactly. They aren't enemies. If God made the world and the world has order, then studying that order through science or math is a form of piety. It's an act of worship.
So in that worldview, doing your science homework is basically prayer.
Essentially, yes. And then you have Johannes Kepler, the astronomer famous for planetary motion. We think of him as a scientist, but he didn't look at the planets and just see rocks spinning in a vacuum. He saw revelations of God's creative work. He literally felt he was beholding the divine blueprint.
It's just so interesting to remember that these titans of science, the people who built the foundation of modern physics, were driven by a theological hunger.
Absolutely. They weren't trying to kill God with science. They were trying to find that unifying principle. And Dr. George argues that the God-math concept is just the modern iteration of that same desire, the urge to find the order behind the chaos.
Okay, let's get into the weeds a bit here, because unifying principle is a nice phrase, but does the math actually back it up? The source brings up what it calls God equations.
It does. It points to universal constants and specifically highlights Euler's identity.
Okay, which is e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0. I think I got that right.
You did.
It's often called the most beautiful equation in mathematics. But to a layperson, it just looks like alphabet soup. You've got e, I, pi. Why is this considered a God equation?
Because it connects five fundamental constants that seem like they shouldn't have anything to do with each other. You have E, which is about growth and analysis. You have pi, which is all about geometry and circles. You have I, the imaginary unit, the square root of negative one. And then 0 and 1, the foundations of arithmetic.
And they all just fit together in one line.
Perfectly. It bridges distinct fields of math, geometry, calculus, arithmetic into a single elegant statement. It feels like finding out that five people from totally different continents who have never met all speak the same secret dialect.
And the argument is, why does that work? Why is the area of a circle always pi r squared, whether you're here on Mars or in the Andromeda galaxy?
Universality. That is the key insight. Universality implies an architect.
Okay, explain that analogy.
Well, if you walked into a room and saw thousands of books arranged perfectly by color, size, and subject, you would assume the librarian had been there. You wouldn't assume an earthquake shook the building and the books just happened to land that way.
So the math is the organization on the shelves. We are deciphering the architect's filing system.
Exactly. We are discovering the rules, not inventing them.
Speaking of rules, the source spends a lot of time on a specific number, the number one, which feels a bit... well, simple. I mean, we learn to count to one when we're babies.
It is deceptively simple. This is the section on the primacy of one. In math, one is the identity element. It's the seed. You can't have two without two ones.
Right. All of arithmetic is built on it.
But the source pivots to the spiritual side here to show the synthesis. It connects that mathematical seed to the concept of the absolute.
Like the Pythagorean monad.
Yes, the indivisible principle. But also the Abrahamic traditions, the Shema Yisrael, the Lord is one. Or the Islamic concept of Tawhid, the oneness of God. Or Brahman in Hinduism.
The singular consciousness.
Right. So one isn't just a quantity. It's not just one apple.
It's a symbol of the ineffable. Unity before division.
It is the source code from which all other numbers and all other things flow.
Okay, so we have the number one as the source. Now let's talk about a specific ratio that the source claims is basically the universe's favorite shape. 1.618. The golden ratio, or phi.
The divine proportion. This is where the God math argument gets very visual.
I remember hearing about this with the Fibonacci sequence. You start with 0 and 1, and then you just keep adding the previous two numbers. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8.
Correct. And the magic happens when you divide a number in that sequence by the one before it. As the numbers get bigger, the result gets closer and closer to 1.618. And the source argues this isn't just a quirky math trick. It is ubiquitous in nature.
The examples were wild. The arrangement of leaves on a stem.
Phyllotaxis.
Yeah.
And there is a very practical reason for it. It's not just aesthetic. If leaves grew directly on top of each other, the top one would block the sun for the bottom one.
Ah, okay.
By spiraling at the angle of the golden ratio, they optimize sunlight exposure for the whole plant.
So what about efficiency?
It is hyper-efficiency. Same with the scales on a pine cone or the seeds in a sunflower. The source cites Luca Pacioli, a Renaissance mathematician who wrote De Divina Proportione. The argument is that this efficiency suggests intelligent design. It's optimizing form and function.
It's the signature of the artist.
Or the engineer. It's like the universe has a preferred packing algorithm.
But wait, I have to play devil's advocate again here. Nature isn't always efficient spirals and perfect circles. Sometimes it's a mess. Jagged mountains, clouds, broken coastlines. That doesn't look like geometry class.
I'm glad you brought that up.
How does divine order explain chaos?
That leads to my favorite part of the source. Fractals.
Fractals. Those are the trippy shapes that look the same when you zoom in.
Self-similarity. Think of a fern. If you look at the whole frond, it's a triangle shape made of leaves. If you break off one branch, that branch looks like a miniature version of the whole fern.
And if you look at a tiny leaf on that branch,
it looks like the branch. It's the zoom-in analogy. The pattern holds up no matter the scale, and the source points to the Mandelbrot set.
The thumbprint of God, some people call it.
Have you seen the image in the notes? That black beetle shape surrounded by that psychedelic halo?
Yeah, looks infinite.
It is infinite. You can zoom into the edge of the Mandelbrot set forever and keep finding new, beautiful patterns. But here's the kicker. That infinite complexity is generated by one incredibly simple equation.
Really?
You just take the output and feed it back in as the input. Iterate.
Complexity from simplicity.
And that is the theological hook. The source suggests this is a metaphor for the nature of God. You start with a simple fundamental truth, maybe God is love or all is one, and from that simple rule, you get the infinite complexity of the universe.
So chaos isn't chaos.
It is just a pattern we haven't zoomed in on enough yet, or we haven't found the rule for it. It suggests that what looks like a mess to us is actually just a higher order of geometry.
That is a lot to process. It makes the messy parts of life feel a bit more intentional. But let's pivot. We've talked about math, nature, order. What about us? What about human connection? The source takes a hard left turn here into sociology with 6 degrees of separation.
Right. Moving from geometry to networks. The idea that you and I are connected to the president or a rice farmer in Vietnam or anyone else by 6 or fewer introductions.
I usually think of this as the Kevin Bacon game.
Right. But the source links it to Paul Erdos. And Erdos wasn't studying movie stars. He was one of the most prolific mathematicians of the 20th century. He studied small world networks.
And what was his take on it?
He believed this connectivity wasn't random luck. He posited that the degrees of separation were coordinated. He actually thought a superior power was acting as the ultimate network administrator.
So the fact that the world feels small is by design.
That is the argument.
Yeah.
The source uses this to claim that the universe isn't a lonely place. It's a web. We are all nodes in a system designed for connection.
Which implies an intent to connect.
Precisely. And that leads us perfectly into the arguably most abstract section of the source, but also the most fascinating, consciousness. Because if we're all connected, what are we connected through?
The source brings up panpsychism.
Panpsychism.
Which sounds like a medical condition.
It does, doesn't it? But it's a philosophical stance. Standard science usually says consciousness is emergent, meaning you get enough neurons firing in a brain and poof, you have a mind. Panpsychism flips that.
How so?
It argues that consciousness is fundamental. It's like gravity or mass. It's pervasive in all matter.
So, the universe itself is aware.
That is the cosmic consciousness visual. Imagine the universe not as a dead stage where life accidentally showed up, but as a unified field of awareness. We're just local receivers of that signal.
And if the universe is aware, then maybe it talks to us. This is where the source brings in Carl Jung and synchronicity.
A causal connecting principle.
Okay, break that down. A causal.
Think about cause and effect. I drop a cup, gravity pulls it, it hits the floor, it breaks. That is cause and effect. Synchronicity is, I'm driving to work thinking about a specific song I haven't heard in 10 years, and suddenly it plays on the radio.
Right. My thought didn't cause the radio station to play the song.
Exactly. There's no physical cause, but there is meaning. It's a connection based on meaning.
And the source argues this isn't just coincidence.
The source describes it as the universe orchestrating events to speak to individual consciousness. It's like the God math dance we talked about. The patterns align to send a message.
And the receiver for that message is intuition.
Right. Intuition is the faculty that lets us hear the symphony.
Yeah.
It's how we sense the connection before we can prove it mathematically.
I like that. It makes those weird coincidences feel like little winks from the universe.
Mm.
But I want to ground this. Because we promised our listener we wouldn't just stay in the clouds. The source has a section on living the vision. How does God math help me when I'm stuck in traffic or dealing with a difficult boss?
It starts with a shift in perspective. The source calls it everyday awareness. For example, look at nature. Don't just see a tree. See the efficiency of the leaves. Recognize the blueprint. It creates a sense of wonder, which is a great antidote to stress.
Okay. What about people?
The source uses the term social mathematics. Relationships are equations. They need balance. Reciprocity, if you're always subtracting and never adding, the equation fails.
That's actually a really helpful way to view burnout.
Totally. And checking your own mood is internal mathematics. Recognizing your patterns. Oh, I'm in a low energy cycle right now. It's a form of self-mastery.
There was also a specific diagram in the source I wanted to touch on, a problem-solving framework.
Yes. This was described as a guiding light for the author. It's a cycle. Acknowledge, analyze, act and assess, iterate.
Which sounds like standard business advice until you get to the core philosophy behind it.
The key insight is every problem inherently contains its solution.
That is the game changer for me.
It reframes everything. Instead of panicking, you become a detective. If the solution is inside the problem, you don't have to flee. You have to look closer. You have to understand the variables.
And the iterate part ties back to the fractals, doesn't it?
Exactly. You try. You get a result. You feed that result back into the process. You trust the order of the universe enough to know that the answer is there if you keep refining the equation. It fosters patience.
Every problem inherently contains its solution. I'm going to write that on a sticky note.
It's a powerful tool.
So we've covered history, Euler, the golden ratio, fractals, consciousness, and practical tools. As we wrap up this deep dive, where does the source leave us? Because we clearly haven't solved the universe in this short conversation.
No, and the source acknowledges that. It points to the ongoing quest. We have things like the mathematical universe hypothesis, or MUH in physics, or the search for a theory of everything, string theory, the standard model.
The holy grail of physics.
The source frames these not just as cold science, but as the modern version of that mystic search. We are still looking for that one unifying principle that ties it all together.
There's a quote from Blaise Pascal that the source ends with, and Pascal was a guy who knew a thing or two about math and God.
It's a haunting quote. God hides from those who tempt him, but reveals himself to those who seek him. Men are both unworthy and capable of God.
Unworthy and capable.
It captures the paradox perfectly. We're finite, messy, confused creatures. We trip over our own shoelaces, but we are capable of understanding the infinite. We can write the equation for a black hole. We can see the spiral in a sunflower and know it matches a galaxy.
We are small, but our minds can hold the universe.
Exactly. The source leaves us with this provocative thought. The universe is not a dead stage. It is an active participant. It says we are in a symphony where infinity intones.
And that leads to the final question for you listening right now. If the universe is speaking through these patterns, through the math, through the sudden coincidences, are you listening? Are you paying attention to the blueprint?
That's something to think about the next time you see a pine cone or look up at the stars.
Thank you for joining us on this journey into the God Math Chronicles.
Keep seeking the pattern.
Catch you on the next deep dive.